WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief, a developing story out of Baltimore County, Maryland, where police say multiple people have been shot in Towson. The ATF is assisting police. New York prosecutors charged the man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO with murder as an act of terrorism. New York City Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch.
It was a cold and calculated crime that stole a life and put New Yorkers at risk.
Madison, Wisconsin police are trying to figure out what caused a 15-year-old student to go on a deadly shooting rampage at her school yesterday. Police Chief Sean Barnes.
Some have asked if people were specifically targeted. Everyone was targeted in this incident, and everyone was put in equal danger.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer proposes legislation in response to drone sightings.
Our legislation will explicitly authorize state and local authorities to conduct drone detection and help them better coordinate with federal law enforcement.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the Bucks and the Thunder in Las Vegas for the NBA Cup Championship. Doc Rivers asked about the Thunder, one of the youngest teams in the league, featuring Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, against the Bucks, now one of the oldest.
They're good. I enjoy watching them play. Shai's one of my favorite players. I actually got to coach him in his rookie year. But and I joke about it. And all these young teams are flying around, and we're going to come in with our little canes and wheelchairs and play them.
College hoops, the Badgers' next game coming up Sunday when they host Detroit Mercy. Wisconsin dropped out of the AP top 25 rankings after losing three straight last week, but beat Butler over the weekend.
Much happier locker room than we've had the last three games, and I think these guys really have earned it. And obviously, when you play really good teams, you're going to have adversity, and how you respond to that and how you use those experiences to grow, I think, tells us a lot about the character of the young men in our locker room, and I couldn't be happier for them.
That's Badgers head basketball coach Greg Gard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Here's why I'm glad I don't work in an office. My wife is always talking about, she's a teacher. They put donuts in the teacher's lounge, there's sweets, there's snacks. It wasn't that way here today, but Nikki keeps those Biscoff cookies out there. I probably ate 12 of those today. The phrase "you are what you eat" is very true, because I was sitting in the office earlier prepping the show and I felt kind of doughy, and I'm like, I feel like a Biscoff cookie.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Christmas party. President Biden held a Christmas party, and ABC News had an interesting quote. The president said, "The one thing I've always believed about public service, and especially about the presidency, is the importance of asking yourself, have we left the country in better shape than we found it?" Today, President Biden says, "I can say with every fiber of my being, all of my heart, the answer to that question is a resounding yes." And I agree with him. I agree 100% that we are a much better country now than we were 4 years ago. What Joe Biden has done during his tenure, cleaning up the mess that was left to him by Donald Trump, a resounding yes that this country is better that he found it. That said, politically, we didn't sell that message. And this is where the Democrats have fallen down on selling. Again, they and I don't think they're going to learn the lesson. I think they're too stuck in their beltway mentality. I think they're still stuck in their elite mentality that we're gonna dazzle you with our data. We're gonna dazzle you with how smart we are. And not really get down to doing the nuts and bolts. You know, I go back to the campaign, and everyone's got their hot take of the campaign, and I get emails every day of, you know, this is what we should do better, and this is what we should have done, is what we were doing here on this program all during the campaign. talking about the economics of the Biden vision, which was to reshore manufacturing, invest heavily in our country, create union jobs that would create better lives for working people, and focus on that, making all of those places that used to be places that are going to be, and selling that message repeatedly. And this is where, not a huge James Carville fan, but he's not wrong. It's always the economy, stupid. And we learned it again. We learned it again because there are people who still believe. And it's remarkable. Even though Trump himself said, yeah, I'm probably not going to be able to do any of those things on grocery bills or rent or, you know, any of that stuff. Yeah, you know, it was never going to happen. And we kept telling people that. And what's interesting is, you know, even after yesterday on the program, I laid out what my red hat friends believe is going to happen. They're still defending the fact that we're going to get dollar a gallon gas, which is never going to happen in my lifetime. Unless, of course, I shouldn't say never, because we are horribly unprepared for the next pandemic, if it happens. But in the event that we do shut the economy down ever again, which I don't think will ever happen, but if we do, then maybe. And it wasn't even a buck a gallon then. So this fantasy that somehow, you know, gas is going to be dirt cheap again because we're going to drill, baby, drill is just, well, it's ludicrous, it's ridiculous, it's uninformed, but it's what the right believes. Because, well, what the right has done masterfully is they repeatedly, to use a Bush frame, catapult the propaganda. And that's what it was. Trump is not going to come in and save the economy. It's not going to be the golden heyday that I don't know who remembers. Because understand, the working class of this country has been under assault for the last 40, 50 years. The Reagan Revolution was about enriching the wealthy at the cost of working people. Again, another good salesman, another good pitch man, another TV guy who we somehow identified with as a country that ended up screwing us. And I don't see Donald Trump being any different from his first term. I think he'll be a little more dangerous this time. I think some of the people he's put around him are more focused on what they want to do. I think the right-wing establishment has come around to the idea that he's their leader and they can, if they appeal to him, they can get their bad ideas through. I do believe that. I do believe someone has gotten into his head, Susan Wiles, of how he can have a legacy. A legacy, you know, probably even worse than Reagan's for working people. Because if you're angry at NAFTA, and you should be, blame Reagan. It was birthed during his administration, fully negotiated under George H.W. Bush, but ultimately signed. The final signature was Bill Clinton. Had very little to do with the negotiations of it. Threw in some half-baked labor and environmental regulations, you know, to kind of put a little lipstick on the pig, but still signed it and has taken all of the blame for it. And somehow Republicans can go, oh, well, you know, we're the party of working people now. And Democrats have done dumb things by going, yeah, okay. Okay. So when I see this, I go, yeah, Joe Biden had a great legacy. And I think history will remember him in a positive light for what he attempted to do. Move us away from neoliberalism. Move us away from the tax cuts for the wealthy and the deregulation nonsense. Because we're getting it. We're going to get it right in the face. Because the slapback is going to be painful. Now, what's interesting to me, I saw a Politico article. Politico is, how the debt could topple Trump's growth agenda. The new president could face even more daunting challenges than his predecessors if he follows through on his tax and tariff pledges. They're already doing the Chamber of Commerce's work for them. This idea that tariffs are horrible, tariffs are bad, we can't do that. Or we can't have a tax policy that would actually be helpful. Now, understand, Trump's tax policy, not going to be helpful for working people. This idea that somehow people making under $200,000 are going to see this great tax break. Has that worked in the past? I mean, honestly, Have you really benefited from Republican tax policy? The answer, no. And this time will be no different. And as far as the debt, everyone's concerned about the debt. Trust me, Trump, at the end of his 4 years, will increase the size of the debt even more than he did the first time around, I believe. Because we're going to continue to give handouts to corporate America. We're going to continue to give handouts to the very wealthy at the expense of we the people. Now, the caveat to that is if Doge Boy gets his way and we do slash and burn Medicare, we do privatize Social Security, we sell off the Postal Service, you know, we basically fire sale our government, then that could be on the short term beneficial to his not increasing the debt and deficit. But what long term do we benefit from? Show me one thing we've privatized and profitized that's actually worked out as it was sold and made our lives better. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Lori Wallach going to be here after the break from Rethink Trade. Going to talk about tariffs. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as you know, we've been pushing back on the reactionary responses to tariffs by some Democrats and, well, virtually everyone on the left. Unfortunately, this seems to be more the mindset that if Trump's for it, we have to be against it. And the problem is if you've ever said, gee, we should be enforcing our trade rules, or gee, I wish we would enforce those labor or environmental standards. I wish we would do something to not get beat up on trade. Tariffs, one of the tools in your superhero belt. And here to explain just that, I've asked Lori Wallach to come talk with us. Lori's the director of Rethink Trade, rethinktrade.org, the website. Lori, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
So let's start right here because, you know, the campaign, I heard the Harris campaign talking about the Trump tax. I heard organizations talking about, you know, Trump's tariffs and how bad they are, and basically reinforcing the corporate message, the Chamber of Commerce message that tariffs are bad. What'd they get wrong?
Well, the way you introduced it is exactly right. Those were all stupid, self-inflicted harms to the efforts to actually have a Democratic president. So we can talk policy and we can talk politics. To talk about the policy, I think, is important so everyone is armed to have this fight about the politics. And you just asked a political question. So let me just tell you what the findings, the data show of opinion research, which is at this point, the word tariff has a symbolic value. The findings of some of the folks who are big free traders, like David Autor, who did the big China shock, you know, these are economists. They have found that whether or not tariffs result in restoring jobs, working class folks now hear the word tariff as stands up for me on trade, fights for my community and my job. It is equivalent to against NAFTA. It has a symbolic value that whether or not you were alive when the NAFTA fight was happening, if you're a working class person, a proxy of whether someone's your friend or not, is do they like NAFTA or not? Tariff has become that. And so the notion of allowing Donald Trump to own that word and be able to associate himself somehow as a champion of working people, a dude who had not delivered on most of the promises on trade that he made in round one, like he renegotiated NAFTA and job outsourcing continued because he didn't do it right. And the trade deficit with Mexico is up, not down. And he still made contracts with companies at offshore jobs. All of that stuff happened. Yet somehow he gets to be the guy who is the champion of working class people, while the Democrats, by basically associating themselves with some very bad history of bad trade bipartisan actions, are the anti-tariff people. Huge mistake.
Huge mistake. And look, all during the campaign, I'm going, look, I'm not for broad-based, you know, bludgeoned kind of tariffs. That's a bad idea. It's like any tool, you've got to use it effectively. You've got to have a plan on how you're going to use it. And you have to implement that strategic plan, of which I don't think Donald Trump has any of. But you're right. He's stolen the issue, like a lot of working class positions and a lot of working class issues. He's got his thumb on the pulse. The problem is his solutions and all of that stuff, in my view, are going to make things much worse, not better. But we'll see how that plays out. So, you know, back to this tariff thing, because you obviously pointed out the political and the policy. What is a smart policy going forward to use tariffs? If you were advising Donald Trump, you know, how would we use this? Because, look, if Trump uses it right, I'll give him credit for it. You do a good job, I'll give you credit for it. But, you know, what would Lori Wallach suggest? What would you advise?
Well, first of all, I just want to reiterate what you said. Tariffs are a tool. So the question is this the right tool for the job? And so you back up and you say, what is my goal? And what are all the tools that I have in the tool belt? So, you know, you don't try and change a light bulb using a hammer. This is going to make things worse. So the question here is, what is the goal? And if the goal is to try and my goal, if I were giving advice, would be we need to restore much more U.S. manufacturing capacity. We need to diversify our imports. So we can't have a huge honking trade deficit where everything that we use, we don't make. But even when we have trade, we need to have more countries. And three, we need to raise standards for workers, protect the environment worldwide. And having this huge U.S. market gives us a lot of leverage to set the rules of trade in a way that can either be lift up rules or push down rules. So if you want to make more stuff here, have the trade rules reflect the kind of world we'd like for workers and for the planet. And there is a national security, diversify our imports, both to bring up the standards, but also because you don't want China basically, if you will, using our trade deficit to finance future military hostilities around the world. If you think of those kind of goals, here's how you use tariffs. You use tariffs basically as part of a package. You use it as a defense, so that you're basically fighting against trade cheating and you're penalizing bad behavior. And so if you think about it, there's some things about tariffs I want to make sure everyone understands, because if you start talking about it that way as a totally legitimate tool, then people are like, oh, but it'll raise prices. That is not true. That's a red herring. Now, sometimes tariffs can raise consumer prices, but I hope you asked me to walk through exactly what that connection is, because it's not what people think.
Well, most certainly, by all means. What is the connection, Lori?
Okay, so tariffs are charged on the wholesale, not the retail. So all of these studies by, you know, groups that ostensibly are trying to elect Democrats for Harris were like a self-inflicted gunshot wound of just like doing the math of like X percent tariff times our entire trade divided by the households. That, friends, is not how it works. A tariff is charged on the wholesale price. So you can predict whether or not it will then have an impact on retail prices based on very knowable factors. So you charge it on the wholesale. By the way, it's not a tax. Now, if there's a across-the-board tariff on everything, that's like a tax. But if you charge a penalty tariff because someone's using forced labor or they're dumping on the environment, that's a penalty. You're trying to punish bad behavior and end it. If you have a countervailing tariff, which is what you put in place, for instance, if they're unfair subsidies, there you're trying to take away the unfair advantage of something being cheaper than it should be priced because there's a subsidy or a government's intentionally dumping. That's a trade term, technical term for when you sell something below the price it costs to make it. And that's typically because the government will pay you an export subsidy or something. So those countervails are basically just making for a level playing field. Or sometimes a tariff is put in place explicitly to preserve some share of a market. It's called a tariff rate quota. So in some amount of the stuff you're going to import is duty-free, some part has a tariff, and you're intentionally building a place, if you're trying to create manufacturing, to create domestic demand, so that the new investment, and you put a whole package of industrial policies together, of tax benefits to create demand. If you buy an American-made car, you get this tax credit. Investment certificates or investment funding, more tax benefits for manufacturing, so deduct the costs of making a new factory. Procurement rules, the government will guarantee buying X amount of the American-made stuff. All of that together, using tariffs to save a piece of the market, is another use of tariff, and that's to basically create, rebuild domestic manufacturing. So those are all the uses. Now, right. What does it do to the prices?
Okay, go ahead. Connect it for me.
So if the wholesale price and the retail price have a huge gap, the vast majority of the added expense of the tariff will just be eaten by the company and they'll have slightly lower profits. Classic example, $120 Nikes. They charge $120 because they've done market research and they know we'll pay that much. The shoe in the US purchased, brought in, tariffed is $20.
Yeah.
So add a 20% tariff, it's now $24 to Nike. Nike's not going to make the shoe $124 because they've done the research that shows they will sell less shoes and make less money. Otherwise, they would have already charged us that much because there's no connection between what it costs them and what they're charging. In that instance, they just eat it in the profits. The research shows the vast majority of the increased cost in the wholesale level of tariffs to China during the Trump era, 95% of those were absorbed in profit. Prices didn't go up. Then, if there is a smaller profit margin, but there is fierce competition for market share, so something doesn't have a huge markup, but companies have spent a long time making sure they keep 20% of the market, they will also eat the cost in the profit margin, not pass it on to consumers, because they want to keep their market share.
Right.
Those are a lot of the circumstances. The place where it can raise consumer prices is if you have across-the-board tariffs, a tariff on everything, coffee, bananas, stuff we're never going to have in volume to make here. Plus, there are no other countries you can substitute. And if you do it right away, so there isn't time for the manufactured stuff to get made here. So immediate, short-term, across-the-board tariffs, then you could see a retail increase. But we don't have to worry about the notion that because of the tariffs, there'll be a big jump in prices. We will see companies trying to use the tariffs as an excuse. And that will just be greedflation.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll be the same price gouging they're doing now.
Right. Walmart, Lowe's, all of them who are already prepping us for the price increases because of the tariffs, they're already doing that. So it wouldn't be surprised if greedflation rears its head. And the question is what does Trump do differently than Biden didn't do? Because I don't think Biden and the Democrats handled that issue well enough.
So, here's the thing. There is a version of Trump putting on across-the-board tariffs that is, there's a theorist. There's a concept behind that. It's basically using tariffs for a one-time, really kick you in the teeth, what's called a macroeconomic correction. And basically, it would for 18 months, they would put up those tariffs for 2 years. They'd force a clearing of the trade deficit. It would be difficult at home, and you'd have to accompany it by things like price caps. You would have to tell the companies, we're not having price gouging here. You do X, Y, and Z to basically not eat this in your profits, then we're going to penalize you with X, Y, and Z penalty. No. But Trump's not going to do that to the corporations because he loves them. Or you would say to them, take it out of your damn profits or else we're going to do X, Y, and Z to you. He's not going to do that because if he took it out of the profits, maybe the stock market would go down. And he doesn't want his corporate buddies on Wall Street to see the stock market go down. So I worry that what they'll do is a little bit like they did last time, which is on the one hand, Bob Lighthizer, the USTR, great American. He broke this hysteria about, oh, we can't use tariffs. He showed you can use effing tariffs, and this, and the earth is not going to hurl into the sun. And in fact, we didn't see price increases. We saw the China deficit go down. But then he had to deal with all these rascals, like the guy who was the Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin, or for that matter, Trump. So, you know, China would be like, hey, we'll give Ivanka Trump some, like, access for selling stuff here and having intellectual property rights to, like, brand her perfume. And then Trump would be like, wink, wink, good for me. I guess I won't do those sanctions. So that kind of self-dealing, that kind of petty corruption, that kind of not really standing up for working people problems, where you've got a bunch of other people being appointed this time too, like the Treasury Secretary and the Commerce Secretary, two Wall Street billionaires, I kid you not, literally like Wall Street billionaires, who run around saying, oh, tariffs, we have to be careful. So how it's going to actually play out versus what he promises, that is a very big question.
No, that is the question, because look, I've got listeners who tell me that, you know, this is what I've, Trump is going to do what I've always been talking about needs to be done. That we're going to blow up the whole system. We're going to restart again. We're going to put sane, rational controls on trade. We're going to produce things at home, domestic production for domestic consumption. I'm told it's going to be everything I've ever talked about and more, and we'll all get ponies. But I'm with you. I don't see it.
I mean, I light a candle for that. I hope that's what happens. But also, you know, I think we have to be very realistic, having seen round one, where Trump is very transactional, and the bottom line he's thinking about most is not all of us at our kitchen table trying to pay the checks, but his own money.
Yeah.
And so I think he's very susceptible to China and other countries basically trying to figure out how the Trump organization's profits can be used to distract him, sort of like squirrel away from standing up for Americans, working class people. I think that there is a lot of, I'll use a very technical legal term, chicken shittery amongst some of the like Wall Street suck ups who are going to be on his, who are in his cabinet about, oh, let's not do anything that could like bring down the stock market value. Here we have record corporate profits and very low corporate taxes right now, which he wants to, you know, make tax cuts to for rich people even more. And of course, whatever expenses of the tariffs, which we need as corrective tools, should come out of their damn profits.
I'm with you.
But that would require him using policies that make it the case. And he's not necessarily going to be willing to get crossways with those people. He wants to like be one of their best friends.
Or unless we give them more tax cuts, massive tax cuts or subsidies, and that we add to the national debt even more. That's the only way I see any of this really working. Maybe Doge boy Elon Musk is right. We're going to have to go through a period of real intense pain. And that means rural America, because tariffs, I think, will hurt rural America more than anyone else. Because the first thing you're going to do to make America squeal on the tariff issue is go after agriculture. And that's rural America.
Well, here's a crazy thing going on right now. Like, ladies and gentlemen, the Republican House, let me present them. They're in the middle of trying to get rid of the pot of money. The reason why there is no continuing resolution and on Friday the government could shut down is because the Republicans, leadership and farm folks are on that committee. There's a farm bill that needs to be extended just for 1 year. They couldn't like do the whole 5-year thing. That's part of that needs to take a ride on the broader government funding. The whole thing is like teetering on the cliff because the Republicans are insisting on shutting down the program that a president can use to try and pay off farmers if they get slammed by retaliatory tariffs. The same fund that was used last time, they're trying to shut it down. So it's like,
of course they are.
Right. Let me see. You want to do tariffs, which we're going to have to use. It's going to piss off countries, so they're going to nail us. But you want to take away the safety net. So you want farmers on the tightrope. You want elephants dancing on the tightrope. So they're bouncing up and down, holding on to their, you know, tractors by their pinkies. And then you want to get rid of the net. That's why right now we have no idea how it's going to play out. Because, again, what they say versus what they do, big gap.
Big gap. And that's why we need folks like you to keep us up to date on what's going on. And I know in the new year, we're going to be reaching out to you more and more as this issue begins to show itself and maybe where we end up. Lori, I appreciate the time, the education, the input. Good stuff.
thank you so much, Rick, for everything that you do. And also, folks, if you see your members of Congress, because they're home, once they go home this Friday, they're going to be home basically through the 5th or 6th of January. Talk them up that you like tariffs, you want tariffs, but you want them smart. You want them to actually focus on getting us jobs and higher wages and raising standards. We know, like, using tariffs, like, somehow for immigration, that's ridiculous. But on the other hand, selling us out as working people, that could be likely if we don't all fight for strong tariffs used smart.
There you go. Larry Wallach, Director of Rethink Trade. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, the website, rethinktrade.org. I highly suggest take a look at that. And like, as she said, you know, you call them. Call them early. Call them often. Knock on their doors. Say hello. And say, look, we need smart governance. And is that going to happen for the next 4 years? I'm not holding my breath. Quick break. Right back.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A few flurries or brief snow showers this evening, cloudy tonight, low 20s. More clouds than sun for tomorrow, a high in the mid-20s. Then snow showers late tomorrow night and a Thursday with accumulations. Becoming breezy as well, highs mid-20s. Currently it's 26.
Earl Ingram.
Chuck from East Troy. Good morning to you, Chuck. You say what?
I have a bone to pick with you. Since my wife discovered Civic Media 2 years ago, we are addicted to Civic Media, and you are one of the ringleaders. So anyway, I just want to thank you. Have a good day.
Hey, Chuck, man, thank you very much for the call. Tell your wife I said thank you, and it's an honor and a privilege.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a couple big stories today. Donald Trump announced, $100 billion? You know, the whole Austin Power thing, $100 billion. Investment from this SoftBank. Only problem is they evidently don't have the $100 billion. But they'll find it, trust me. Trust me. When they can take over AI and they can take over the infrastructure of the country, they're gonna find it. But that was part of the big argument. And also, Joe Biden's got an article out over at the American Prospect I found really interesting. Evidently, we're in the middle of the end of bottom up economics, and we're returning fully to trickle down fantasies that will enrich the wealthy and, well, enrage the working class. And as I was reading Biden's article, I was going, man, this sounds like some really great stuff that maybe a campaign could have run on, you know, like investing in infrastructure, reshoring manufacturing, strengthening unions, the higher wages, you know, kind of stuff that during an electoral campaign would have been good to hear. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, are we going back to the trickle-down fantasies? And, will we get $100 billion in investment from SoftBank? I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
So let's start with the SoftBank. They say they're going to $100 billion, and Trump said $200 billion, and the guy, I guess, chuckled along. Sure, why not? Any thoughts?
Well, look, I first want to say that I am someone who thinks that foreign investment under the right circumstances can be good for the United States. It's good. I mean, the idea is that instead of outsourcing everything, that you want to bring some stuff back to the United States. And some of that is going to come from global companies that are not based in the U.S. Now, let's get into the details, though, because they kind of matter. And with respect to SoftBank, when I saw this was happening, you know, I don't remember everything, and my spouse can certainly attest to that. But I do remember in the first Trump term that SoftBank made a similar pledge about investing in the United States something to the tune, I think, of $60 billion that never really materialized. The biggest investment they made was in WeWork, which was the kind of failed co-working company. You remember WeWork?
I do. I was against it then. I'm against it now.
Yeah, that's right. So okay. So you had that, and then you have the fact that everything, you know, you can add 15, 20, 30% to whatever Trump says as being, you know, that he's inflating it a little bit. And then so you get this $100 billion number, and you're right. I mean, the available investment acumen of SoftBank is less than that by a lot. So they'd have to enlist some partners and leverage some other, you know, equity and to be hedge funds or whatever to be able to come up with that. With those kinds of resources. And then the final question, I think the most important one is what are these investments going to be at?
There you go.
Is it going to be in companies that are going to displace, incumbent companies in the United States that are already putting Americans to work? If that's the case, I don't know that I'm for it. Artificial intelligence, maybe. Let's see what the details are about that and how that's going to contribute to better jobs in the United States, because if you do it the right way, you can end up with that in the right circumstances. But just count me. First of all, I'm going to take the under on the amount of number and on the amount of investment actually made. I'm going to take the under by a lot. And then I'm not going to hold my breath that a lot of this is put into productive ventures that are going to put a lot of Americans to work and aren't going to displace other jobs. I would be delighted to be proven wrong about this. But unfortunately, between SoftBank Part One, the China deal where China was going to buy tens of billions of dollars worth of American products, never happened. And then the whole Foxconn big investment thing in Wisconsin, where they're going to create 20,000 jobs. It ended up being maybe 1,000 jobs at a Microsoft facility that came in to do some artificial intelligence work. You know, it's just like, yeah, there tends to be way more hype than results on all of this stuff, Rick.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you hit it right. Anytime Trump's involved, the pitch is always much higher than the results. But, for me, yeah. And I look at this a little bit differently. I look at the fact that AI, I think, is going to be such a game changer. I don't feel overly comfortable having foreign investors controlling that. Mm. The fact that they're making investments in data centers and semiconductors and energy here, I kind of have some reservations. And then you throw Trump into that mix. Now I have a lot of reservations because I don't know that we, the working people of this country, are going to benefit from any of it.
Yeah. This is one of those. I mean, I'm trying to think that, so many cases, technology has got ahead of what, you should be able to do from a social perspective, too. Yeah. And we've seen this with social media. I mean, it is wrecking a generation of kids, because we're kind of too late to figure all this stuff out, and still there aren't really any controls on it. This also happened with the way the internet spawned and all of this, and it was very, there's a lot of whiplash from all of that. And so we're definitely at a point where the technology, the AI is way ahead of our ability to, I think, understand it and to ensure that we're harnessing it as a force for good and for progress.
Instead of just for pure profit. And my problem is you've got Trump who came out and said, we're going to be slashing regulations. So the fact that you're going to make this country the wild, wild west so business interests can profit, and now you've got this foreign investment coming in with this new technology that, as you pointed out with social media, has been a game changer. What does that next iteration, as social media dies off, because garbage in, garbage out, what's that next bit going to be? And that I got to tell you, makes me a little weird.
Yeah. Well, and rightfully so. And I think, again, you know, I don't want to prejudge, but there's a strong reason to be concerned that the interests of the American worker are not going to be front and center in these conversations. Because yeah, you're right, it's going to be all about profit and how can we make the quick buck, and all of that. And so, yeah, I'm not, you know, again, you know, SoftBank, nothing inherently wrong with foreign investment in the United States under the right circumstance. If they think it's a great place to invest, if they think it's a way to curry favor with Trump, you know, that's obviously problematic too. They're not the only ones doing that. I mean, you have every CEO practically down there.
And they're all in the administration now. So, you know, the best government CEO class can buy, we're about ready to get. But he talks about creating 100,000 jobs and not what kind of jobs those are going to be. And this is where I go back to Biden. And I think Biden has done, I thought he did very well. In fact, you know, I brought up his piece over at the American Prospect. It would have sure been nice to hear about all of the things that he's done during the campaign and maybe why you'd want to stay the course, as I was arguing all throughout the campaign. It sure would have been nice for the campaign to talk about that.
Yeah, and I just have to believe that if working class voters had heard a message that said, I'm the only president who has not negotiated a new free trade agreement since we started these things back in Reagan's days. I'm the only president since the 70s who is leaving office with more manufacturing jobs than I came in with, right? And, you know, I walked the picket line. There's more factories under construction now in terms of investment than there ever has been. And yeah, I get it. The jobs aren't all materializing right now, which is I think probably one of the reasons why it made it hard to sell some of this stuff. But the, you know, it's like pouring the foundation, you know, the solid foundation of a great economy. And then even on the flip side of the trade front, they were just afraid to talk about it, right? Like about leaning in on the tariffs, or I wasn't a free trade president. And I you know, Trump put tariffs on. I put more on than he did, you know,
Trump the Trump with the tariffs. Absolutely.
That's right. And I got more people to do it. And we're not going to let any of those, you know, Chinese EVs in or whatever it is. But no, it was really like they took the action. You were supposed to look at the list and ooh and ah, but it wasn't really, you know, it's almost like they were afraid to lean in to some of that. Other areas of economic populism they touched on, but, you know, it was not, you know, it was certainly a missed opportunity. Yeah. And yeah, if you read that Prospect piece, you look at it, you're like, that's a really damn impressive record. It's going to be hard to ever top that again from a Democratic president, you know, in terms of helping working people and trying to build up the middle class. I mean, this was like a, you know, you see this every once in a while. I guess we saw it with the Great Society in the 60s. We saw it in the 30s. Both of those had problems in terms of like equitable distribution, much more equitable this time. But I don't know next time we're going to see this.
No, and this is the reason I bring it up. Because one of the things that I had talked about all during the campaign was Joe Biden's presidency was transformational, moving us away from neoliberalism, moving us away from business-centric, business first and foremost, and actually talking about the effects of work for working people, actually talking about, you know, that being at the front of the list instead of an afterthought tack on later. And I thought that this was really a transformational moment that, you know, had they sold as we're building towards something, aspiring to something, a call kind of to national action, that'd have been great. I think that is now dead. I think we will revert back to what the worst parts of what our economy has become, especially as Trump keeps talking about deregulation and you know, doing all of the slash and burning that an authoritarian leader will do. That's got me concerned.
Yeah, of course it does. And you know, what's going to remain standing, what's going to get slashed, there's a thousand different questions, Rick. You're absolutely right. How much of a strategy there's going to be behind all of this to try to lift up working people, right? I mean, because it's clear the eyes are on a different prize right now. It's on deregulation. It's on big tax cuts for corporations, and it's on austerity for everybody else.
Exactly.
And so, you know, that's not a great blend. I think for middle class success, we'll see.
Yeah, right? I would throw in there also privatization. I think there's going to be a mass fire sale of the things that the Postal Service being, I think, at the front of that list, that will be even more privatized. I think Medicare will finally be completely privatized during these 4 years. And then, you know, hey, you know, United Health Group may be the new Medicare. We've got real issues, real problems, and real concerns that working people need to understand. It's not all going to be sunshine and rainbows and used car salesman pitches. There's going to be very real consequences.
There will be. I will say this. I think it's incumbent on Democrats to challenge Trump on that. I don't know that just saying, you know, you should fear all of this is good enough, though, because clearly that didn't deter Americans from voting for the guy. Right. You know, and so I think they also have to say, you know, here's how we're going to take care of your basic human needs and achieve fairness and to do some reflection and say, clearly we missed the boat. Right. I mean, clearly we missed the boat on this, but it's time that we, you know, restore that sense of fairness, that we listen to you, and that we're going to go out and fight. And here's our plan, right? Here's how we are going to put you front and center, instead of just saying the other guy is going to do this, that, and the other thing. And yes, you got to say that at some point, but that can't be it. Cannot be it.
No, we'll see what the new year brings us, what the new administration brings us. Who knows? You know, Trump may be the greatest thing since sliced bread this time around. Maybe a change of heart. Who knows? But we'll see. The big holiday, though, I got to get your thoughts on the big holiday coming up. Have you finished your Christmas shopping? Have you gone through your Christmas list? And did you buy all those American-made gifts that you're out there promoting?
American made, yes. And sure, I'm going to lie and say I'm all done with my Christmas shopping. But if you haven't, there is a great resource, but time is running out, right? On our website, the holiday gift guide with 112 gift ideas from all 50 states that are all made in America. And just literally, if you go through that, I promise you'll find something for someone who you love or care about who want to give a gift to.
Or you can just send something to
no
me.
No doubt about it.
Or you can just send me something because, you know, it's made in America. We want to get people working. We want to support American businesses. And, you know, I've been good.
That's right. Hit Rick up, man. There's a lot of stuff on there. I picture they make a sled in outside of Buffalo, New York that I think has your name all over it.
No, and Buffalo is the perfect place to make said sled.
It is. It's battle ready and tested, that's for sure.
There you go. I hope people will go to AmericanManufacturing.com. Check out the Alliance for American Manufacturing's website, Scott's site, and find that buying guide and get your holiday shopping done. Scott, I wish you the best. Happy holidays to you, your family, and all your loved ones. And I look forward to getting back in touch in the new year.
I can't wait. Thanks so much, Rick. And let's look out for a brighter 2025.
I'm right there with you. Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, where you will find that gift idea log. And like I said, I'm always accepting. You got any thoughts? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1944. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt rescinded Executive Order 9066. It had forcibly relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans into internment camps. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the government considered Japanese Americans a national security threat. By 1942, many were given less than a week's notice to sell and store all property. Whole families were rounded up and taken away to desolate areas in the west and southwest of the United States. Up to this point, many Japanese Americans in California were employed in the agricultural industry, some as tenant farmers. They were responsible for 40% of all produce grown in that state, whose crops were valued at $40 million annually. Over 6,000 farms, consisting of 200,000 acres, were confiscated. Once interned, they were subjected to dire living conditions with little in the way of running water, sanitary facilities, or medical care. They were subject to forced labor in the construction of camp buildings and cultivation of near barren lands. The government hoped to make the camps self-sufficient. In Poston, Arizona, they were made to build the infrastructure for Colorado River Tribes Reservation in order to consolidate other tribes onto the land. When Japanese Americans were finally released, most found their stored belongings stolen and their homes, jobs, and farms confiscated and redistributed. After the war, they continued to face violence, job and housing shortages, and racial discrimination. Ronald Reagan would sign the Civil Liberties Act in 1988. It acknowledged that internment was based on, quote, race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. The act served as a formal apology and sought to distribute billions in reparations.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Donald Trump hasn't even taken office yet, and you've already got Steve Bannon out there saying, you know, Donald Trump should consider a third presidential term. He should run in 2028. We still haven't seen the chaos and the destruction that he's going to do in 2025. They're already pushing him to run for 2028. And oh, by the way, you know, he's not going to live forever. What will he be like? Like 8,500? I think it'll be 82, actually. Yeah, but okay. Understand the wealth class of this country thrilled they got their guy. The moneyed interest of this country thrilled that they've got their guy. Now, Steve Bannon, the argument, and again, childish, clearly didn't take high school civics or middle school civics or any of that. His argument is that Trump didn't serve two consecutive terms. So because there was a break, evidently, he can run again. And that's not how it goes. So when he said that, you know, my mind went to, well, does this mean in 2028 Obama can run? The answer is no, Obama can't run. But it would be interesting to then see if we're throwing that out the window, which, to be quite frank with you, I've never been overly thrilled with. I'm a believer. It's the same thing with term limits. I'm not a term limit guy because I think ultimately the voters should be able to make the choice. And if you have someone you like, stay with it. If not, well, you throw the bums out. It's that simple. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Thing that it's really kind of interesting to me. Elon Musk spent $200 million, you know, $250 million on getting Trump elected. And for his investment, his wealth has jumped by $200 billion. You know, that's pretty good return on investment. It's kind of, you know, along the lines of, you know, something my grandfather always said. And this is what I was saying during the campaign. If a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket or 250 million of them, maybe you figure out how to not go along with him, because he understands return on investment. 200 million to get 200 billion. That's three more zeros. That's a lot of freaking money. And what's interesting is we're now seeing that power, you know, manifest itself in interesting places. You know, for instance, there was just a story by Reuters that, you know, that they've got, that they've seen a document that the transition team that Trump has is going to drop car crash reporting requirements. You know, Musk's against the idea of reporting. A data guy, understand, this is a data guy being against the collection of data. Why? Because it's not good for him. And what they want to do, again, this whole deregulation fetish, this whole attack on government fetish, is about ensuring that we don't know the bad things that are going to happen. So if you cripple the government's ability to regulate safe vehicles, for instance, or to investigate crashes, especially when you're talking about automated driving systems, which are now becoming, you know, more and more prevalent, if we're not actually getting real data, and we're not actually getting real numbers and being able to investigate the things that happen, all we're going to have to do is, well, I don't know, take Elon Musk's word for it. And gee, what could go wrong there? When the richest guy in the world spends money, he kind of expects a return on investment. And as the chief cook and bottle washer over there at Tesla, with all of the crash stuff that they've got going on, seems like a really good investment. Seems like one that, you know, a smart business person might do. You know, you buy your government, you buy the best government money can buy, and then you rig it so that no one ever sees what's going on. Yeah, that's it. And are you comfortable with that? I guess that's the other question. Me, not so much. Also, I thought the Wall Street Journal had an interesting article about Musk and his SpaceX program. Evidently, and I didn't know this, that Elon Musk doesn't have national security clearances and probably won't as Doge Boy either, unless Trump waives, you know, whatever the requirements are for you to be investigated, because, and this is the Wall Street Journal saying that the reason that Musk and hasn't sought the higher security clearances is because that would give him access to really sensitive data about their space programs, and that our government would kind of want to know a little bit about his dealings in foreign countries and dealing with foreign nationals and you know, his past drug use, for instance. There's a lot. There's a lot there. And also that, you know, he may just, you know, in the most Trumpian way possible, inadvertently, you know, let out some, you know, sensitive information to, you know, the not so good people that we don't want not so good information getting into their hands. So I found that interesting that that Tesla and SpaceX and all those people are going, well, maybe you don't get that clearance. Maybe you don't put us in that jackpot. And yet now he's now Doge Boy. He's going to cut your Medicaid. He's going to go slice and dice Medicare. He's going to privatize the post office. He's going to push for all of these things. And for the people who say, well, you know, there's an agency that doesn't really matter. It's not going to really, you know, amount to anything. Oh, no. This guy is going to exert pressure like nobody else can, because he's got almost $500 billion. He controls what was Twitter. He controls a large media space and a lot of crazy right wingers. And this is the weird, bizarre part. Hold on his every word, because evidently he's smart. You know, he's rich, so he must know everything. And he does. He knows some things. He knows how to screw working people. He knows how to fire workers when they want to form a union. He knows how to stiff people out of wages. He knows how to do a lot of that stuff. And you know, look, that's a business person. That's a CEO. That's what they're supposed to do, right? Well, it is what he is doing. So we'll see. I'm I got to tell you, it's going to be interesting to watch what Doge Boy gets away with and how far Trump lets him go and how out of control him and his friend Vivek, how far they go. Because again, you know, what they suggest, I would have to tell you, maybe you pay attention to. because it's not going to be good for you or me. It's not going to be good for working people. Guarantee that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Also, check out freespeech.org for the video. As always, appreciate your time. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls. W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Steel.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The latest on a developing story out of Baltimore County, Maryland, where firefighters responding to a car fire find multiple gunshot victims. At least 9 people have been shot and 1 is reported dead. Baltimore County police say it appeared that this is an isolated incident and a targeted shooting. New York prosecutors file additional charges against the man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Luigi Mangione is now charged with first and second degree murder, including 1 count of murder in the second degree as an act of terrorism. CBS's Anna Schechter.
Well, they need to prove that he intended to create terror and to terrorize the citizens of New York. So it wasn't just targeting Brian Thompson, but with that act, creating fear and chaos.
Rex Huerman, accused in a string of deaths on Long Island, New York, known as the Gilgo Beach killings, is now charged in the murder of a 7th woman, Valerie Mack. Suffolk County District Attorney